Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. And I'm your host, Alia Breininger. Our guest speaker today is Rebecca Gold, author of Traitors and Rebels, The Literature of Insurgency in the Caucasus, which was published by Yale University Press in 2016. Rebecca is currently a reader in Translation Studies and Comparative Literature at the University of Bristol, and today she will be talking about her pioneering work at the intersection of Slavic and Middle Eastern studies.
It is my huge pleasure to be talking today to Rebecca Gold, who is the author of Traitors and Rebels, The Literature of Insurgency in the Caucasus. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, Olga.
How are you doing today?
I'm great.
So thank you for finding time to do this podcast interview. I'm really excited about it. And perhaps we could start by talking a little bit about your background, like scholarship, and what took you to the study of the literature of the Caucasus.
Sure. And thank you so much for inviting me to this program. I would say that I began my life as a scholar, or just as a lover of literature, with Dostoevsky, reading Dostoevsky in translation when I was maybe 16, 17. And so naturally, when I arrived at Berkeley, I decided to major in Russian literature. And I spent a few years immersed in the Russian canon and really falling in love with these writers. But this was also at the time when one of the worst Chechen wars was taking place at the same time. And so I was really struck by the kind of dissonance between sort of the world that I was reading about in literature and the world that was occurring outside the classroom. And also struck by the fact that, you know, there didn't seem to be much kind of curricular resources to give me guidance in terms of understanding this conflict. And so when I graduated, received my undergraduate degree, one of the first things I did was book a round-trip ticket to a place I had never visited, which was the North Caucasus. I actually took a train to Vladikavkaz and then traveled through Nalchik and Dagestan and even briefly into Chechnya under a big jacket, so I was basically concealed from the police. But it was interesting. I stayed with a refugee family there. And that absolutely, I mean, that experience really opened my eyes in multiple ways. I think at the most maybe superficial level, it opened my eyes to kind of another side of the conflict. But even in a deeper, more historical sense, it opened my eyes to a kind of diversity of literatures and languages and cultures of people who had Russian as a lingua franca, but whose lives and traditions and histories and sense of identity were defined by something that was quite different from anything that could be encompassed in the Russian language or the Russian tradition or anything in my undergraduate education. And so I realized, like, this was a world that I had to be a part of. And so Russian was a kind of gateway to that, but it wasn't enough, right? I wanted to immerse myself in these traditions. So I applied for a grant to the American Councils, and I ended up living in Tbilisi for 2 years. Officially, the goal was to study Chechen, but I ended up becoming immersed in Georgian. I was very privileged to have a very, very intensive immersion language experience, and actually translated a book while I was there that was published several years later, a book of Georgian fiction by the writer Alexander Kazbegi. And also, when I was there, that was the period when I was really introduced to the literature of the Caucasus. So maybe I'll stop there.
Well, that's a very exciting start to the interview. So let's talk more about your time in the Caucasus. I read that there have been 8 years of field work, which went into the book. Is this so?
Absolutely, yes.
So could you please tell a little bit more, or maybe much more, about that?
Sure. So yes, it was an extraordinarily intense period where I came to Tbilisi basically knowing Russian, not knowing any Georgian and or Chechen. But somehow I think it was just because I was in this, like, I had no other job, nothing else to do other than immerse myself in the culture. So I ended up kind of becoming a part of my environment very quickly and learning Georgian really quickly as well. And I traveled around a lot to the Pinkisi Gorge, as well as to the North Caucasus. And every day, I just remember sort of every day I would wake up and feel like, you know, I was exploring things that no one had seen before, at least no one back in the United States, things that had not been documented by scholarship. And it was the most interesting. Well, I had lots of conversations with local scholars and just sort of, I mean, I was given the background of the Chechen Wars, I was, of course, very interested in understanding how people related to Russian rule. But also, I think that not just in the contemporary moment, but historically, how do they see themselves historically in relationship to Russia? And so that was a kind of question that I posed to everyone I met. And the answers to those questions became my book. So, I mean, I can tell you about those answers, but maybe I'll turn it to you, or you can ask me.
Well, I'll ask you many more questions about this,
okay.
But since you already gave us a segue into your books, so perhaps we could talk about what
sure.
the main themes of the book are, and maybe also about your conceptual framework, which seems to be very like pioneering and innovative.
Thank you very much. Yes. Okay. So now I'll get back to what the answers to my questions were. People I spoke with from, I think significantly for the book, from many different social demographics. So professors, villagers in Pinkisi Gorge, just a range of students and so on. And there was one figure, or I could say like a term in a sense, or just a phenomena that was kind of constantly reiterated when people remember the history of resistance to Russian rule. And that was the abrek, or the bandit, is one very imprecise and imperfect way of translating this term. And it is, of course, it is a Russian term, although many Russians may not know it, but it is a term that exists in the Russian language. But it comes from the languages of the Caucasus. So every Caucasus language has their own version of this word. And it's a sort of unifying, one of the many things that kind of unify the ethos of this culture. And it occurred again and again. People would talk about brechestva and banditry as a kind of way in which, as a response that was made to colonial rule. And also at the same time, I was immersing myself in major literary texts from Chechnya, from Georgia. And this theme was occurring again and again and again. You have this bandit figure. And so I started to ask myself, you know, why, what is the history of this? Why is he, and it is always a he, why it's so popular? What is the appeal really of this figure? And so the more deeply I read, what I saw, it was very interesting to me, was that this is not a colonial, this phenomenon of the bandit does not begin with the colonial period. Pre-colonial, it goes back maybe at least to the early modern period, 14th, 15th century. There are legal codexes in Arabic, for example, that talk about banditry as a problem. And there's folkloric sources as well, so that it would be completely inaccurate to say that this begins with colonial rule. But what's really important, and this is the big paradox for me, was that this figure, when he appears in pre-colonial sources, he is vilified, and he is not a hero at all. This is someone who is to be punished because he violates social norms, and so there is no space for glorification. And then slowly, especially with the late Tsarist period, you have this figure, Zelim Khan, who is probably the most famous abrek. And whenever reports are made of him, even in folkloric text ballads from this period, there's this sense of someone who is very bold and very courageous, and who even has a kind of, I don't know if mystical might be going too far, but who has this kind of uncanny way of administering justice. And so his violence against the Russian officers is seen as inherently just. And the term is the same. You know, the genealogy of this figure is clearly in pre-colonial sources, but his signification is radically different. And of course, there's a kind of tension in my work, I think, between history and literature, because I mean, you can definitely see this by reading through the reports of the time. I mean, which of course are mostly Russian, but you see this sense of people sort of rallying around, Chechens rallying around these figures. At the same time, I do think that literature played a very significant role in the aestheticization of this figure. And so that, of course, means that it was a kind of, to some extent, it was a kind of elite rewriting. In other words, authors who came a generation later, who sort of rewrote this history, they were very much responsible for aestheticizing the violence of the Abrek. But then subsequently, those representations of that history have shaped how, for example, Chechens understand their own history. So I think the interface between literature and history is very, very intense. So that's basically the theme of the book. I mean, it's looking at literary texts that are engaging with the problem of anti-colonial resistance, and that are kind of uniquely open to the possibility that violence has a purpose that can serve a just purpose. Now, you know, I don't take any kind of position on it at all. I just think it's important to kind of register that as a fact of these literary histories, that has been a theme. And then there are equally a very large number of writers who contest that theme. But the point is just that it was an argument that was made and that had a kind of traction in these contexts. And the trope through which that argument was made was this bandit figure. And I think, you know, again, what's really interesting to me is just the number of languages and literatures that this occurs across. So it's not restricted to Chechen. Georgian, of course, has had a very interesting relationship to the literatures of the North Caucasus, given that it has a Christian tradition. But I've looked at many, many, many Georgian writers, both in this book and in general, who take it as a kind of point of pride that they can identify with their Muslim neighbors. So one of the chapters is about the modernist poet Tidzian Tabidze, who kind of figures himself as an Islamic warrior. And so this is very much, I mean, it is basically a study by a scholar of literature who's interested in the way that literary texts refashion reality. But then again, I think that these literary refashionings actually change reality as well subsequently.
So that's very interesting. And I think that's a good point for us to stop and talk a little bit about the methods. So you bring up literary anthropology as your working, say, like framework. So what is literary anthropology? How is it different from literature studies, and how is it different from anthropology?
Great question. I think one way to begin by answering that question is that I do think that the kind of method in which I found myself pursuing over the course of the research for this book is very much a product of the world in which I was working. So say had I think the Caucasus itself lends itself to a kind of literary anthropology, perhaps because many of the literary traditions of the Caucasus begin as oral traditions, and then during the Soviet period they acquire literary form. So literary anthropology, in my view, is a kind of methodology that's very suited to the Caucasus. Also, I mean, those scholars who are specialists of the Caucasus will know that it's interesting that the field itself of Caucasus studies tends to be mostly shaped by anthropologists and historians to some extent. I'm not aware of many scholars of literature. So bringing a literary perspective to what is normally rendered in an anthropological context is, I think, part of my contribution. As to what it is, I guess I see it's more of a kind of recognition of the affinities between the two methods. I actually, when I finished the initial phase of research, I began a PhD program in anthropology, and then I suddenly realized it took me about a year to realize that's not where I belonged. But it made sense at the time, and I think because yes, I mean there's an affinity in my view between the way I understand literature or literary studies, the methods that are closest to me and the anthropological method, in the sense that it's one that's open to contradictions and ruptures and discontinuities in a way that other types of disciplines that may look for kind of focus more on final products and are less open to. So that I think is methodologically what draws me to the two disciplines.
So perhaps we could talk about the central concept of your book, which is transgressive sanctity.
And you could
tell us how you came up with this concept, what does it mean, and what kind of analytical insights it gave you into the study of the literature of the Caucasus.
Great, good question. So transgressive sanctity, again, it comes from my engagement with this figure of the Abrek, and trying to understand the transformation that took place in moving into the colonial period, as well as into the Soviet or late Tsarist period, you know, why a figure of derision became a figure to be celebrated. And clearly, this is very much to do with the transformation in legal norms that colonial rule introduced. Because in pre-colonial times, when the Abrek violated social norms, normally it was by raiding, conducting a raid at a neighboring village. And sometimes, you know, it was seen as being potentially with a good reason to give food to his own villagers or something like that. But it was not condoned. It was condemned. Because it was a violation of legitimate laws and just laws, right? This was seen as the glue that holds society together, and they were, in a sense, communally agreed on. So the violation of those laws was an antisocial act that was not celebrated. But then with it, you have a new, I think I would say kind of a radically new system of governance enters the Caucasus, well, different parts of the Caucasus at different times. But at the North Caucasus, relatively late, it's particularly, I'm thinking of Chechnya and Dagestan in particular, which is where I'm mostly focusing my research, I would say the kind of transformation I'm talking about occurred maybe in the late, so the 1850s and 60s, but particularly after the conquest of Imam Shamil, after the surrender of Imam Shamil. That is a kind of watershed in terms of my book. I mean, that's when the story begins. Because prior to that, in 1859, prior to that, there was a sense of Russian rule, at least within Dagestan, within the stronghold of the Imamate, Dagestan and Chechnya, Russian rule has been somewhat external and somewhat at a distance, right? And then suddenly you have a conquest, at which point it's no longer possible to just keep Russian legal norms at a distance. And this was clearly perceived by the peoples inhabiting these regions as an unjust imposition of a legal code that they did not play a role in creating or participating in. So that is I think, in a kind of legal anthropological perspective, or, you know, from many different angles, that something radically new entered the sort of ethical systems at that point, because I don't think there was really a prior example of any kind of form of governance that so radically and so rapidly transformed local relations as what happened after the surrender of Imam Shamil. And these were laws, again, that were, I mean, I talk about it in my book as the kind of tensions between Zakon, the Russian colonial law, Sharia, and Adat. So there was already a kind of two different forms of kind of legal pluralism at work in the Caucasus before Russian rule, Adat being customary law that had a sort of ambivalent relationship to Sharia. But with the introduction of Zakon, that necessitated a new kind of relationship to legal norms, because suddenly the legal norms did not come from within; it came from an external force. And so, transgressive sanctity, I think, begins with this moment. It begins with the moment when suddenly the violation of legal norms can confer sanctity on the person who violates those norms. And that's exactly what you see happening with the Abrek. You see, again, in folkloric sources, this is very much, it very much historically follows immediately after Shamil's surrender, because not everyone agreed that Imam Shamil, and that was his choice, and some people felt that it was the right thing to do, because he was beleaguered by the Russian army, and obviously, you know, the Dagestanis were not going to achieve a victory. There was no other path. But there were many also who believed, and in terms of how this is remembered in Chechen history, the Chechens always say that they were the ones who, in contrast to the Dagestanis, they were the ones who were opposed to ever surrendering, right? And so they did not support ultimately the kind of any form of reconciliation with Russian rule. And so what happened after Imam Shamil surrendered is that you see this resurgence of banditry, abrechistva. Many, many, many new types of abreks are recorded in various ballads called ili. That's a Chechen term for a ballad. And there's just more historical evidence for it. And so suddenly the violation of these norms are, in a sense, that's the path to sanctity. Whereas under the imamate of Imam Shamil, when there this was a community that was ruled by Islamic law, obeying, you know, working within that system was the path to sanctity. There was a kind of a rule of law, and to be a good Muslim, you had to obey those laws. But once Imam Shamil surrendered and there was no rule of law coming from within, then for a certain strand of thought, to be a good Muslim meant violating those laws. So transgressive sanctity, that's where sanctity comes into play. It is attaining sanctity through the act of transgression. And I'm not too explicit about this, but although I don't think I ever would have, you know, kind of reached this argument without specifically what I learned from reading the literatures of the Caucasus and looking at the histories and so forth, I do think it applies to other contexts, and other colonial contexts. In Algeria, for example, anti-colonial resistance, which also they had their own imams, their own sort of war against colonial rule, and there too you have the emergence of a certain kind of banditry that's sanctified. So it's not restricted to the Caucasus. I began to see it in other places as well when I would sort of compare, but I do think it's most in the way that I've described it, it's most fully realized in the Caucasus, and I would say specifically in connection with Chechen history and Chechen cultural memory.
So something I find particularly fascinating about all these things you say is the idea of the plurality of legal systems. And how
right.
about we stop a little bit and talk about adat, sharia, and the zakon, Russian law, and what are the differences between them, and also how this translated into everyday experiences of people living in the Caucasus?
Sure. And of course, yeah, different answers for different time periods. But adat is really it's very interesting. It's the kind of, you might say it's an Islamic reconstruction of pre-Islamic law. So the term itself is Arabic, but it's used to describe what existed before Islam. The legal systems that existed before Islam. And of course, the Islamization of the Caucasus happened at a very different, according to a very different time scale for each of the literatures I look at. In Dagestan, there was Islamic culture. Most Dagestanis considered themselves Muslims as early as maybe the 9th or 10th century. Chechnya, very interestingly, because it's a neighboring region, but again, just part of the diversity of the cultures, it wasn't so heavily Islamicized until maybe the 18th century. So adat, although it, in a sense, when we speak of it today, we associate it with Islam because it's an Arabic term, and it's now kind of part of Islamic legal systems that actually precedes Islam. So when I talk about the kinds of regulations that applied to the abrek before colonial rule, I'm talking about adat. I'm talking about these sort of local codexes that would assign forms of punishment to people who violated certain norms. And very much adat is very much it's not in contrast to Sharia, it doesn't really aspire to any kind of sort of philosophical significance. It's more about sort of how daily contact, daily regulations, rules for everyday management of resources, family practices, so regulations around marriage, customs, and so forth. And in many ways, many actually Muslim reformers of Dagestan in particular were actually kind of campaigned against adat in the 18th century. They saw it as this kind of vestige of superstition and backwardness. So Sharia, you know, they're not really fully contrasting because in most contexts they coexist, but they refer to very different kind of spheres of everyday life, right? So adat's very much about regulating daily practices and behavior. And again, it's pre-Islamic, but it was sort of incorporated into Islam. Sharia is referring to the path, right? It's kind of more, has more of a ethical dimension. So it's more, it's more easily, and maybe more of an ideology driving it, right?
Interesting.
Yeah. And then since Zakon is, yeah, a totally different, different phenomenon entirely. And it's very interesting to reading through the Barikat of Al-Karaki. That's the annals, the chronicles from the life of Imam Shamil, the campaigns that Imam Shamil conducted against Russian, the Tsar. These three different forms of legal life are very much conceptualized. And so there's discussion of zakon, for example, transliterated into Arabic, and a sense of it as being this sort of problematic legal system. I think that's that needs to be a framework through which the kind of the complexities of basically what is right and what is wrong is adjudicated. It's never a straightforward thing, and it depends on who's asking the questions. And I think, you know, one of the limitations I felt to some extent with my undergraduate education and just with my immersion in the Russian canon was that these issues were always looked at from the perspective of Pushkin and Lermontov. And of course, they identified at some level they recognized the injustice of it. But I think once you start looking at the world, at these colonial incursions, from taking these different legal systems into account, then it just becomes a bit more complex.
So do I understand it correctly that, you know, one of the, say, broader goals of your book is also to bridge, say, this Russian or Eurasian studies and Middle Eastern studies?
I would say yes. Of course, yeah, Middle Eastern is a sort of a modern term, but yes, I mean, that's the best we can do in terms of geographies. But yes, I think I think it's the first book that that brings these literatures together, and which is really quite a shame. I mean, given how just how much Arabic literature Dagestan has produced, which is, I mean, the diversity of genres, poetry, historiography, scientific text, and I feel like I'm only kind of glossing the tip of what is there.
Could you talk a little bit more about that? So how widespread was writing in Arabic? What kind of text, you know, are there available? And also, why were they writing in Arabic rather than, say, in Avar or Kumyk?
Sure. It changes with the language that was used. It changes according to the century and so forth. But Arabic was definitely, I think one very clear reason why Arabic was the language of choice for most scholars of Dagestan, and interestingly, not only under the 19th century, but basically until, you could say, the 1930s, under Soviet rule, because it was a way of communicating. I mean, the same reason that Dagestanis speak Russian to each other, right? An Avar and a Kumyk are unlikely that they'll be speaking in Avar. It was a lingua franca that not just united them as a group, but that connected them to the broader Islamic world. And so a lot of the texts, manuscripts from Egypt, writers from Egypt were in communication. Some of the major Islamic reformists from Al-Azhar, the Islamic University in Cairo, were in close communication with Muslim reformers in Dagestan, precisely because Arabic was their chosen medium. So I think that's, you know, it makes sense. What's interesting is just how the level of accomplishment, attainment in Arabic in Dagestan, and that, I mean, I don't, yeah, I think that that's actually kind of exceeds explanation. It really is a kind of miracle. I mean, the tens of thousands of Arabic manuscripts that are found in mosques and so on is really a case unto itself. I think another thing worth emphasizing is just the diversity of genres. It wasn't just religious materials. Poetic production was very, very much very popular. Different types of genres, collections, tabakat, or which is a major source of information or sort of a resource for me to engage with. Biographies of different scholars every sort of Muslim scholar would produce their own chronology, their own history of their teachers. So that's a very important genre. And it wasn't just Arabic. So Arabic was definitely, especially in Dagestan, it was by far the most important literature. But It's also another kind of paradox of this region, which is in some the Caucasus or the North Caucasus. Although there is so much in common, like, for example, the Abrek, which is not just confined to the eastern or northeastern Caucasus. It's also very much evident in Circassian literatures as well. They all have their own version of the Abrek. But the kind of fluorescence of Arabic literature is, as I see it, it is pretty much a Dagestani phenomenon. So Chechens, for example, did write much more in Chechen and much less in Arabic. And that is largely probably, or at least partly, because the written tradition itself was more developed in Dagestan. So a lot of Chechen literature is oral literature. And also, it's not just Arabic. In the south, in Derbent, Persian was probably at least as popular, that they were on the border with Azerbaijan. So Persian and Azeri as well. And one of the writers who I is a very important source in general for me and in who I engage with in my book, Hassan al-Qadadi, wrote major works in all three languages, Persian, Arabic, and Azeri. And so, yeah, that was pretty typical of the time. It takes quite a mental energy to just put it all into one place. But I really do think, I hope that my book makes a case for seeing these literatures in relationship to each other, notwithstanding their very significant differences.
Oh, it definitely does. Good. And, you know, with every little detail which adds to our conversation, there's just picture of this cultural and linguistic diversity and complexity of the material is just absolutely growing. Well, how about we dive into the book? So we've already talked about the methods and your conceptual framework, Transgressive Sanctity, which is what was largely the content of the introduction. So how about we talk your first chapter, The Abrek in Soviet Chechen Literature? So what is it about?
So the main focus there is a novel. Well, there's two novels that are the focus. One is by, and I think you see the kind of cross-cultural dimensions you were talking about, actually by an Ossetian writer named Zakho Gatuyev, or he was sometimes called himself Konstantin Gatuyev, who published in the 1920s, published a biography of Zelimhan. And that was building, drawing on primarily journalistic sources. It was about 10 years after the assassination of Zelimhan, the most famous Abrek. And so the fact of his undertaking to, again, this is someone coming from a very different, a neighboring people, but not someone who, you know, had no particular reason to glorify a Chechen resistance fighter or a Chechen bandit. But he undertook this as his subject. It was kind of the task he set himself. And in addition to that, to engaging with that novel, calling it a novel is a bit, it is a novel, but it's a novel that's very kind of self-consciously journalistic, and that it literally cites from journalistic reporting and includes historical like images in the text itself. So clearly he was a journalist himself as well. So I think in terms of his genre, it has a kind of unique status. In addition to that, there is a manuscript unpublished in a Dagestani archive that I found in 2006, where he has his travel notes traveling through Chechnya in the 1920s. It's fascinating to read it. And just interviewing local people about the Abrek, the figure of the, about Zelimhan primarily, again, who is the most famous Abrek, but he signifies something more than just this one person, right? And so he basically did what I did, except in the 1920s. So he's a very big inspiration for me. I think he's a really great writer, unfortunately, he was assassinated under very kind of obscure circumstances.
Yeah, I hope the parallelism between his and your stories ends here.
Good point. Yes, I don't think that, hopefully that won't happen to me. But he was one of the victims of the purges, as probably a good proportion of the writers that I look at were from different cultures. So that's the kind of, this is a text that launched, although it was, as I said, it's building on already pre-existing kind of ethnographic traditions about banditry that he gathered from his own field work. It's building on folklore. It's building on journalistic reportage. But in a sense, this is the book that launched the Soviet phenomenon of the abrek in the 1920s. And in terms of kind of from a literary perspective, it's also very interesting in that its style is sort of experimental. He actually puts, he has these pads, like particularly when he narrates the death of the abrek, which is a very sort of paradigmatic moment. It parallels the surrender of Imam Shamil. This is like a watershed moment when the famous glorified Zalim Khan is killed by the Tsarist army. Because when this is narrated, it's always shown that Zalim Khan had this kind of immortal capacity that it was almost impossible to kill him. And because he had this kind of lifeline to the divine, I mean, really, that's what I meant as transgressive sanctity. He had special immortal qualities. And so Gatuliev, that's already, you can already see that in folkloric text, and you can see that as well in journalistic reporting of his assassination. But then Gatuliev takes it to another level because he's writing, in a sense, he's writing fiction, but kind of historical or documentary fiction, as he calls it. And when narrating that death scene, he puts these Arabic, strangely, you find like transliterated Cyrillic Arabic words inserted with Zalim Khan reciting the Quran as he dies. And again, that's sort of, it's like a embellished, you would say, a fictionalization or an aestheticization of the historical event. And so I think it's just a very interesting text from a literary perspective, and very interesting to see a kind of tradition being created, but on the basis of an already pre-existing tradition. And then in the 1960s, this, of course, the theme is repeated in various texts, but I think the very, very second major contribution to this literature of the Chechen bandit is in 1960s with Magomed Mamakayev, who is probably, I would say, the greatest Chechen writer, and really, very unfortunately, is just doesn't really have any recognition at this point, even within the field of, say, Eurasian studies. I hope he will, maybe through my book partly, but he produced a really amazing biography of Zalim Khan that clearly is engaged with Gatuliev's novel, but it's kind of much more philosophical, much more a psychological portrait. And it really, I think the ethical ambiguity of violence is really the central question of this work. And so Magomed Mamakayev, although he was Chechen, of course, he's more ambivalent towards militant violence. And he portrays the effects of Zalim Khan's choices to kind of make himself into basically a criminal, an enemy of the state. He portrays the effects of that on Zalim Khan's own immediate family. And so portrays sort of some of his family members discouraging him from pursuing the path of violence and others taking it. It's a portrait of a very compelling individual. It's a very humanizing portrait. And so I think as a kind of Bildungsroman, it's just a great work. So it's basically an analysis of those two novels. And also some later sources from the 1990s and even 70s as well, because again, this isn't just like a one decade thing. The theme occurs again and again and again, and you find it as a constant reference point during the Chechen wars as well. So it's just looking at the trajectory of this figure of the abrek over the course of Chechen history.
Well, great. So how about the second chapter, which is called Regulating Rebellion: Miracles, Insurgency, and Dagestani Modernity. How does the theme of abrek continue in that chapter?
So there it sort of broadens out into the question, the issue of violence and anti-colonial violence in general, and specifically the more sort of familiar Islamic concept of jihad. Because as I kind of signaled towards earlier, the Dagestani types of engagements with any kind of major philosophical questions. The Dagestani culture is much more deeply rooted in Arabic traditions and Islamic traditions as well. So it takes a more kind of classical Islamic form of engaging with the problem of violence. And so I'm looking at historical chronicles that narrate the choice made in the under Shamil's imamate, or just before then, the choice to engage in jihad against the Russian empire. It's taken as a kind of, I mean, there's a philosophical genealogy to the question of, you know, when is it just, when is it not just to engage in this kind of violence. So that's a point of departure. There are chronicles that narrate this choice and narrate it from the perspective of Islamic law. Then I look at how later, after the surrender of Imam Shamil, how later Dagestani sources, in a sense, came closer to the Chechen approach to violence, which was more of a kind of desperate, the Abrek is someone who basically doesn't think of consequences. In fact, that's a phrase that is used, that there's a kind of dignity. After defeat, basically, there was a kind of emergent literature that would say, well, you know, we're destined for annihilation, so all we can do is just resist to our deaths. And this, I think you can doubt, I mean, research in terms of these various texts shows that is coming more from Chechen material, but it's taken over later by Dagestanis after Shamil sort of abandons the scene. And so it's sort of looking at the influence of Chechen culture on Dagestani modernity.
Great. Well, and your next chapter is dedicated to Georgia. It is called mm-hmm. The Georgian Poetic of Insurgency, Redeeming Treachery. And an outsider might think that Georgia would be a part of this narrative in a very different sense than Chechnya and Dagestan. But then in your work, you reveal that there are actually much more hidden connections one wouldn't think.
Sure. Absolutely. And I think again, that maybe one could say that this is a contribution that literary studies can offer. Because, of course, if you're going to be very, very, if you're going to just take basically historical context as the primary determinant of what's relevant and how you're going to organize your research, it wouldn't really make sense to go back and forth between Chechens and Dagestanis, because, of course, they're responding to radically different realities. But at the same time as they're responding to radically different realities, the poets themselves reached out to their neighboring peoples and kind of constructed common narratives, even sometimes, or precisely because they felt a lack of actual solidarity on the ground, right? So Georgians were not fighting side by side with Dagestanis. To the contrary, as many scholars of the Caucasus know, Georgians played a leading role in the conquest of the Caucasus. So that would be the historical approach, right? To just kind of narrate those chronologies. And I take a different approach because I'm interested.
And literature does undermine the historical approach, right?
I think to some extent, or at least it offers a necessary corrective, absolutely. And so the Georgian poets that I'm looking at were very troubled by the Georgian legacy of complicity. I mean, that's what they called it, with Russian rule and kind of unquestioning allegiance to the Tsar. And really, basically, you know, Georgian, they were very troubled by the tendency of many of their ancestors to kind of put their own nation first and to ignore the implications of that for the peoples of Dagestan and Chechnya. And so the particular poet who's the focus of that chapter is Tizian Tabidze, someone who I've worked on a lot, and I just another unsung hero of literary history, really an absolutely brilliant poet. And I've a lot of his translations are now available outside the book as well. I've published them in various places. There are many, many important poems that he's produced. But to my mind, one of his most courageous is what might be called the Shamil Cycle. So it's a series of poems that he wrote about Imam Shamil, the Avar warrior of Dagestan, who was a symbol of resistance to Russian rule for many peoples of the Caucasus. And these are all very interesting poems. But to my mind, the most interesting one is called Gunibi. In fact, I could try to recite a little bit of it, just
yes,
so people can hear the Georgian.
Go ahead.
Because it's really, I remember when I was sitting in Tbilisi and I came across this poem, and, you know, my Georgian wasn't fluent, but it was good enough that I could kind of get a sense of the what was good and what wasn't, basically, in poetry. And I just remember being absolutely blown away by seeing this written on the page. Gadavire Dagestane Vnahe Gunibi,
Giavurivar davar meins ehla muridi. Some of those words are recognizable to not speak those who don't speak Georgian, like giaur and murid. Murid is an Arabic term used to describe followers of Imam Shamil. It originally has a kind of Sufi connotation, so it's someone who follows their Sufi master. But in the context of the Caucasus Wars, a murid was a follower of Imam Shamil, so basically someone who engaged in this jihad against Russian rule. And giaur is the Turkic word for infidel, right? So the poet is saying, I entered Dagestan, I crossed into Gunib, I am a giaur. He says, I am a giaur, I am an infidel, and now I am a murid. These are very, very powerful lines,
yeah,
right?
Fantastic. Absolutely.
Yeah. Think of all the different perspectives that he's channeling into those two lines. I mean, all the different, basically conflicting narratives, all the histories that are condensed into that small number of words. I mean, I think it's really great poetry. And so I read that and I'm like, okay, this is definitely changing my perspective on things. And he goes on to basically imagine himself. This is, again, a Georgian poet writing. He was actually assassinated the same year as Zako Gatuyev. They didn't know each other, but, you know, shared that common fate because they were both seen as kind of dangerous subjects under Stalinist rule. He is imagining himself as a warrior under Imam Shamil against Russian rule. Oh, and I should mention that right at the time when he produced this poem, he was translating Haji Murat, Tolstoy's Haji Murat. So
that whole network of connections around it, right?
Exactly. Which is a very famous text about the resistance to Russian rule by Tolstoy. And it's one of, I think it does stand apart from, say, the other texts of the Russian canon that engage with the Caucasus, in that it really, Tolstoy really went out of his way to understand the local perspective and this Chechen perspective as well. He studied Chechen. He took it very, very seriously. And that's a bit different from his predecessors of Russian literature. But importantly for my book, that was recognized by Georgians and Dagestanis and Chechens. And so this is a literary text that has entered local histories in a way that I think Kafkaski Planning, for example, Pushkin really hasn't. It hasn't been as interesting to peoples of the Caucasus. So Tatsyan Tibidze was translating this text. He wrote some essays about Tolstoy as well. And then he produced his own cycle of poems about imagining himself as a warrior under Imam Shamil. And I also, just as much as I love those first two lines, I love the last two lines. Let's see if I can remember it. Meitzir poems rom Diet host Kweni Halati. So he's gone through, and I'll translate that in a second. He's gone through basically in this poem, seeing himself on a mountaintop, right? Ogunib, I should mention, that's the name of the poem itself. That is the site of Imam Shamil's surrender in 1859. So it's a hugely significant moment in the history of the Caucasus. And so Tatsyan Tibidze imagines himself as part of this community, basically fighting to the end. And then he starts, he has this one line where he returns to his Georgian brothers. That's what he says, Chemo Dzmebo, my brothers. And talks about how they were on the front lines of the war against the Dagestanis. And in fact, specifically, anyone who knows Georgian literary history knows that he's specifically referring to some of Georgia's major poets, such as Grigol Orbeliani, who served as an officer in the Russian army. So it's a very hard hitting poem with very, very specific references, although he doesn't name them, but he doesn't need to name them. So it basically has this kind of litany where he's indicting as he calls them, Georgian brothers, but you know from the context that it's really, he's indicting them with complicity. And that last line, Mevsed poems, I write poetry. So to redeem your treachery. I think it's a great line, and it's a great justification of poetry. I mean, after all, like, what better reason is there to be a poet than to redeem treachery? So that's, again, it's one of those kind of foundational texts for my argument. There are two, you know, you see it's a very different kind of sanctification of violence, but it's definitely taking place. I mean, it's a sense of, you know, he's not troubled by the jihad itself. You know, he's troubled by the conquest of the Caucasus. And so there is, I think, a certain kind of aestheticization of violence, certainly. And it's a literary aestheticization. Maybe that's worth saying. All of these writers who were glorifying anti-colonial resistance were actually in actual practice not going around killing people. But they were trying to place that history in perspective and using literature to do that. So, and in a very literal sense, it was very, very courageous of Tizian to write these poems. And I was very privileged when I was living in Georgia to get to know his daughter and his granddaughter as well. I paid a visit in 2000, I paid a visit in 2005 and then 2006. And then when I came back in 2014, his daughter had died. But at least I got to know her, for some periods. And I have actually, there's an interview that's available, publicly in, the journal Guernica, an interview with his daughter. But what I learned very importantly from that interview is that, at the time when he was arrested, and he was accused of being a spy, Tizian Tabidze was accused of being a spy for America. That was the reason for his execution.
Very ironic. And
of course, he'd never been there. But he was writing a novel about Imam Shamil. And that, of course, it's presumably disappeared from the world.
So we don't have the unfinished manuscript?
No. His daughter did not have any access. Yeah, but he told his daughter that he was writing it. And so he was clearly very, very interested in this topic and its theme. And the poem was not published during his lifetime. And it was also not translated. A lot of Tizian's poetry actually is translated very well into Russian by Boris Pasternak. He was very lucky to have a lot of very important friends, Tizian Tabidze. But that poem itself was not, the Guni poem was a bit too dangerous, I think, even for the 1960s. So I integrate these stories into my narrative, which is part of the sort of anthropological aspect of the literary history that I tell. So that's what the chapter is primarily about, Tizian Tabidze, but it's also about other. I'm also just trying to think through these forms, these networks of solidarity, you could say, that were created by Soviet writers by using these various tropes and to kind of help them collectively overcome the damage that had been wrought by their governments, right? Because they were very conscious of having, as writers, having a different sense of justice and a different sense of accountability than governments. And I think you see that with Tizian Tabidze, you see that with Jacko Gatuyev as well. It's just a common theme.
Well, so now we have the Chechen, the Dagestani, and the Georgian chapters.
Right.
And then you come to synthesize them all in chapter 4, which is called Violence as Recognition, Recognition as Violence. So what happens in this chapter?
Right. So this is a departure methodologically. It isn't concerned with any specific literary text. It is an attempt to come to terms with my own encounters with violence in the Caucasus when I was living there and traveling through the region. And so the kind of point of departure is with a time when I was in Nalchik, living among Chechen refugees. And I was a guest, and I was sort of being, of course, told these stories of resistance. And one of the Chechen women reached into her purse, and she took out a photograph of a woman named Aizan Gatuyeva, who was one of the first suicide bombers in Urus Martan, and she blew herself up, as well as a Dagestani official, following the murder of her husband. And so What was interesting to me is that this woman, Aizan Gazuyeva, was remembered in very heroic terms by the Chechen by Chechen interlocutor. And in fact, I was asked after the story of her story was told, I was asked if I could basically distribute her photograph when I returned to America, if I could show it to CBS and put it on the television screen, so basically everyone would know the suffering of the Chechen people. You know, and I'm not really sure that that would have had the intended effect that it
yes,
did.
Yes, I don't quite agree with you on this one.
But just that was the perception that it would, I think, does suggest a kind of continuity in terms of the sanctification of transgression, right? And then the kind of paradox of what do you do? How do you even take any positive step in a context where your rights are being violated on all sides? I think that's a common context within which transgressive sanctity emerges. So it seemed to me that it isn't just a phenomenon that's limited to literature. Now, I recognize, of course, I mean, there maybe are methodological issues with moving back and forth so much between literary text and ethnographic experience. But I it's very clear to me that those my interlocutors were themselves familiar with the literary traditions and the folkloric traditions. So they were themselves responding to that representational reality that I had described in the previous chapters. So it's just an attempt to really think through, I think, what a genuine glorification of shahidki, of suicide bombers, that definitely, you know, certainly existed at the time when I was conducting field work among Chechen refugees. And I don't have any answers or any I think it's really dangerous to try to kind of diagnose these issues or, you know, psychologize it all. It's an attempt at documenting the conversations I had and placing it within that larger trajectory. And also, as well, it's the only chapter I should mention that's really seriously engaged with women's experiences, because the tradition of banditry is very much a male-dominated experience.
Well, one question which arises from what we are talking about is, of course, the ethical stance of the researcher who is dealing with violence and, you know, the necessity of taking some position or not taking any position at all and trying to remain as neutral and as objective as possible. So what's your take on this?
I think this occurs to me that this is perhaps something where both anthropology and literature have, again, a kind of shared affinity I would see it at least in contrast to a more traditional historical methodology, whereas, you know, even of course there are many historians who very firmly believe in not taking you know, and also being sort of passing judgment. I think methodologically, because historians are methodologically kind of compelled to look from the outside, right, and to get a contextual overview of a situation and use contextual details to reconstruct a situation, the kind of imperative to pass judgment is a bit is heavier than someone who works as an ethnographer or as a scholar of literature, in which at least I feel my own position as a researcher is to observe and to record and to be particularly attentive to contradictions. And that's it. Like, I want to document as many contradictions and ironies and discontinuities as possible. I think that that's a kind of step towards arriving at some kind of maybe resolution, but I don't make that resolution myself. I think it's, you know, thinking things through from a kind of, I would hope, at least this may sound a bit ambitious, or a kind of indigenous perspective or in a local perspective, and looking at the contradictory celebration of violence as well as its condemnation in other contexts. That's my methodological stance. And I think if I had been thinking as a historian, I would have been a bit more pressured to maybe step back and look at kind of the ineffectiveness, as I just pointed out to you now, right? That I really don't think it would have helped to like distribute this photograph to the world. But that at a certain level, like, that's not so relevant for that. Like my objective historical, you know, perspective of its not being useful does not really help get at the core of the story. And so yeah, that's how I saw. I see my own position is that as an observer and as someone who is open to the complete irresolvability, actually, unfortunately, of these conflicts.
Well, this has been a really fascinating conversation, Rebecca, and thank you for being so generous with your time. So
my pleasure.
Before we part, I just wanted to ask you about your current research plans and, you know, what kind of projects you're working on. So what's coming next?
Right. Well, I have actually a very related project that I will be concentrating on for next academic year because I'll be on leave. And so I'm very lucky for that. And I hope to have it finished soon. It's called Narrating Catastrophe, Forced Migration in the Caucasus from Colonialism to Postcoloniality. So it has, it brings together kind of a similar set of texts in the sense of Georgian, Arabic, as well as some Chechen texts, but looks at the response to violence from a very different angle. I'm not looking at militant resistance. I'm looking at the narration of catastrophe, particularly the narration of forced migration, and how this was remembered in these three literatures. Primarily the forced migrations that took place following the surrender of Imam Shamil in the 1860s, as well as the 1944 deportations of other Chechens and other peoples of the Caucasus to Kazakhstan. And what just as with the first project, and I think because I kind of think as a scholar of literature, I was really interested by the rhetorical repetition of this bandit figure. And that's what made sense for me to put all these texts together. So too, with this project, what interests me is not only kind of the documentation of specific historical events, but the fact that in the literary text I'm looking at, these events are remembered and associated and compared to a very paradigmatic event in Islamic history that long predates any of this colonial rule, which is the Hijra of Muhammad from Mecca to Medina. This is the inaugural, it's the beginning of the Islamic calendar, the inaugural migration that is seen to, in a sense, mark the beginnings of Islam itself. And it is a migration significantly that, as reported in the Quran and as well as in various lives of the Prophet, that was a forced migration that was taken under duress because Muhammad felt that he was under threat of persecution by his neighboring tribesmen, the Quraysh, and he had to go to Medina. But when he arrived at Medina, he was greeted with his followers on a horse, so as a kind of sign of victory. He was greeted with open arms. And he was given the free space for the first time to really create a community where Muslims could openly practice Islam. And this is a paradigmatic moment in Islamic history. It's remembered again and again and again at various periods of forced migration, all the way from, say, Al-Andalus, when Muslims were expelled from Al-Andalus during the Reconquista of 1492. That is also called the Hijra. But most particularly for the purposes of this project, under colonial rule, when following the conquest of the surrender of Imam Shamil, many Chechens in particular and some Dagestanis were told they had to leave to Ottoman lands. That is also a hijra. And that's how it's recollected in local literatures and sources. And even in Georgian texts, too, there's a Georgian word for this. The muhajir is a migrant, and muhajirba is a Georgian term. So there's, again, like a kind of proliferation of text around forced migration that bears some kind of relation, and sometimes it's a bit distant and mediated, but some kind of relationship to this founding narrative of Islam. And even up until the 1944 deportation, which is a really a sort of watershed tragedy for the Chechens and for many peoples of the Caucasus, when a third of these peoples died on their way to Central Asia, this has also been narrated as a hijra, as a forced migration. And I'm very interested how during the Soviet period, many of the Chechens and Ingush who were forced to migrate to Central Asia wrote their major historical novels about the 1860s forced migrations. Of course, they could not write about the 1944 deportations, but you see this kind of allegorization of Hijra taking place even there. So that's the overall arc of the project. And I think it's just useful, kind of a corrective to my first book in the sense, because I don't want to reify violence in the caucuses. And that's already an existing stereotype. I don't want to suggest that that's the only meaningful narrative that was generated. In fact, this is an equally salient narrative, these narratives of forced migration.
Wow, that sounds absolutely fascinating. And I really wish you the best of luck with this project. I'll be looking
thank
forward
you so much.
To it. And thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Rebecca Gold about her book, Writers and Rebels, The Literature of Insurgency in the Caucasus. And I hope that so did you. We have many more exciting speakers lined up for the forthcoming episodes of our podcast, so please stay tuned and keep listening to new books in Russian and Eurasian studies. Take care and goodbye.